Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you're disabled, you know that technology can make a big difference in your life. Joining us again from Assistive Technology of Ohio, a federally funded nonprofit organization at OSU, is Bill Darling. He's director of the Assistive Technology of Ohio, and we just welcome you back. We were just scraping, you know, scratching the surface the last time you were here.
That's right, Ann. Thanks. It's great to be back.
I had to push him out the door. He's like, wait, I have more stuff to show you. So I said, well, we'll bring Bill Darling back. And first of all, let's just briefly describe for folks what Assistive Technology of Ohio does. And
We go by AT Ohio, or Assistive Technology of Ohio. We're here at Ohio State. It's a federally funded program, as you mentioned. But what we do for the state. So it's really for anyone in the disability area. And we just have a lot of programs that focus on the types of technology that help people live independently, whether that's go to school or work or just stay connected with friends and family. So one of the unique things about our program, it's all focused on technology, and it is across the whole spectrum of disability. It really can be any kind of disability, any age.
All right. So if anyone has any questions about technology for disability, for any stripe of disability, you can give us a call. Maybe Bill Darling can give you some direction or more. 614-292-8513. Don't wait. He's on for the first segment only. So let's talk about, you've brought a lot of computer-related gadgets, keyboards and so forth. How much of a role does the computer play in what you do?
Well, it's really a big part of the focus of our program. It's just that computers are so prevalent in society today. And people with disabilities are still the least likely among us to own a computer, know how to use it, have access to everything that we just take for granted.
Is that because of income or?
A lot of it is socioeconomic.
Okay.
It really is. And the programs that they're involved in won't necessarily buy them one. So we have programs that not only help them get a computer, which we have our computer donation program, but we also have a lot of our technology is focused on teaching them or making it easier for them to use a computer.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Bill Darling. He is director of AT of Ohio. If you want to see what we're talking about, I recommend you check out our online. We're streaming online live right now at WOSU.org/allsides, and you can see what we're talking about. So go ahead and tell me, you've brought these are like mostly alternative keyboards.
They are. There's all kinds of different ways that people with disabilities interact with the computer, and in many cases, the traditional keyboard just doesn't work. If you look at a keyboard, if anyone's near a keyboard, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense the way that it's laid out. It's actually laid out historically as a way to try to slow you down, going back to the days of the typewriter. And it causes you actually have to work pretty hard to type.
Why did they want to slow you down when the days of the typewriter?
Well, back
since I hearken
when
back
I mentioned
those
the typewriter to college students here at OSU, I get kind of a blank stare. They don't know what I'm talking about. But on the old days when there was one keystroke was tied to an individual hammer stroke.
Okay.
If you typed too fast, the hammer strokes would get all caught up in the typewriter. So they had to devise a keyboard that specifically slowed you down. And the QWERTY keyboard is one of those examples in life. It drives people crazy when you say, well, why do we do it this way? And the answer is because we've always done it this way. And there's no greater example of that than that type of keyboard. And we have a keyboard here. It's called a Dvorak keyboard, which is a totally different kind of layout. It frustrates you at first, but it is actually a lot easier to use once you learn how to use it. And when you look at the way that it's laid out, if you type for 8 hours on a traditional keyboard, your hands are going to travel probably about 12 miles. If you type for 8 hours on this type of keyboard, it'll only travel about a mile. So it's just a lot less stress on your hands and for repetitive use injuries and things like that. But it's an excellent example of a type of keyboard that
how essentially different is it from what about my keyboard?
Well, yours is the QWERTY keyboard. It's known as QWERTY because if you look at the top line, QWERTY, that's what it's called.
Oh.
At. And the what this keyboard does is it lays out the keys that are most likely to be used right in the home row. And so it makes you travel a lot less. You have to reach across the board a lot less to reach the keys that you're actually needing and using.
Why do they call it the Dvorak?
That's the name of the inventor back in the 30s that actually came up with the layout.
See, I thought it had something to do do with a composer or something.
No, no. It's a composer's name, I think. It sounds very similar.
Right. Okay. So that's the layout of the keys. The actual layout of the keys differs from what the traditional typewriter.
That can make a difference. But what you see here is it's called a Big Keys keyboard, which is a very obvious name for it. And if there was an assistive technology Hall of Fame, the Big Keys keyboard would be one of the charter members because it solves so many problems for people that have a physical difficulty with keyboarding. Some people, their hands are shaky, or they may have cerebral palsy. They just can't have the fine motor coordination that it takes to be a good keyboardist. And a lot of times, just the simple Big Keys keyboard will make that difference because these keys are four times the size in area of a regulation keyboard, and they make far, far fewer mistakes.
They're colored, too. They are yellow, colored. Red, blue, and green.
And I know the yellow are the vowels, and so you can find those easily. And I don't know the distinguishing feature between the red and the blue and the white, but I think it has to do with how often you need those particular keys. But this is it's just a great device that solves a lot of different types of problems.
Is that very expensive?
It's less than $200. It really is, and it's something that it makes a big difference. So many cases we have, that's just, it's a real go-to for us.
And one of the good things about what you do is you have a lending library,
right.
So people don't have to spend the money on something until they know it is working for them.
We have some very specialized keyboards that cost over $1,000 that operate on a laser, things like that, and it may be the perfect thing for you, but you really, it's hard to pull the trigger on a $1,500 device, and then it arrives, it's not what you thought it was, and you're out all that money. So we have a device lending library where not just computer equipment, but across the whole spectrum of disabilities, you can try out this equipment, a lot of which is very expensive, so that you know, yes, this is what I need, or you learn that this is not what I need, so you don't go ahead and make that wrong purchase.
And is there a fee for borrowing?
Absolutely not. There's no fee at all. It's a free service. If you're local and can pick it up, that's great. If not, we will ship it to you and pay for the shipping to come back. And if necessary, we'll come out and show you how to use it and make sure that you're acclimated with it.
Okay, then we have you mentioned the laser image.
You can barely see it. This is a laser image keyboard that it's just what's called the Magic Cube, and it projects a laser image onto any flat surface.
And how does it work?
Well, it's a Bluetooth capable keyboard. So if you open up your smartphone or if your computer is Bluetooth compatible, on your screen you'll get a little message that says type in a 4-digit number. And once you type it in on this little keyboard, this keyboard is your keyboard now. And one of the reasons that we have this, and another example of a small keyboard would be this iPad port that we have. For a lot of people with disabilities, you know, the smartphone is so prevalent, and everything
is the greatest device of all.
Right, is wonderful, but it's a tough interface for a lot of people. When you try to type on a smartphone, you make a lot of mistakes. Even people without physical disabilities, that's what autocorrect is the entire industry is based on.
Well,
that.
Some of the funnest things to do is go
right.
to the website.
There's a lot of humor on the website just based on that function alone, and a lot of that comes from people mistyping. There are people that just have to have a keyboard. And so two examples are this little handheld one that can go into my two hands, and it's just a regulation keyboard.
It's bigger.
It's bigger, but each key has its own feel. It's an actual keyboard, Bluetooth compatible, or you can use the laser image keyboard that's shining a keyboard right on the desk. That works just as well. Either one of these you can just carry with you, and when you need to create text on a smartphone or iPad or whatever, you can just pull out your keyboard and start doing it that way.
So with the laser, can you adjust the size of the keys?
Well, you can if you lift it up,
okay.
but it has a kind of a general distance that it goes.
And is it a QWERTY?
It is a QWERTY keyboard.
Now that I know what that is.
Yes, it is a QWERTY. It's the traditional layout. So
there is a picture of the keyboard on Facebook. There's a picture of the Big Keys keyboard on the Facebook if anyone wants to check that out. At the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. And if you have a question or comment for my guest, Bill Darling of AT of Ohio, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Okay, so we've done the laser image. And with the laser image, you just put the device right in front of you and then...
Right, it's just wherever you would have the device next to you and
right.
the keyboard can be wherever you need it to be.
And what else do we have? The IntelliKeys?
Well, you have... One of the interesting ones that we have is a device called IntelliKeys, which has been around for a long time, and it is basically just a flat board that connects to your computer. And what IntelliKeys did is they just totally rethought of what a keyboard is. And what you have is hundreds and hundreds of overlays that you just lay onto this. And whatever you lay onto it, that becomes your keyboard. It can be the traditional Forat, it can be Dvorak, or it can be just colors or yes and no or whatever level it is you're working at. We have a keyboard that is just the seven New England states because there's a program that you learn about that. So it just puts the keys that you need onto a keyboard. If you look at a traditional keyboard, if it has a number pad, you're looking at probably 104 or 105 different buttons on a keyboard. And for kids or people with cognitive disabilities, that can be incredibly confusing and not necessary. So what IntelliKeys basically allows you to do is create any kind of keyboard you want or need that works best for the person that you're working
with. Can you
show
me an example? Do you have some?
Well, you can pull out. Here's an example. This would go with a specific type of program.
Okay.
Those are the only type of keys that you need. A left arrow, a right arrow, okay. A picture of a flower,
colors.
A picture of a house. And when you slide it in there, it reads what kind of layout it is. It understands mm-hmm. it, and then that projects onto the. And so you have the ability that this just basically becomes your keyboard. And it can be a science related one. It can be math or any other type of subject has layouts, or you can create your own layouts.
And this is the
IntelliKeys.
IntelliKeys,
right?
Keyboard system.
And we have some others. One of the things that's interesting is if you have someone who only has the use of one hand.
Okay.
We have lots of keyboards that are set up for that, and it's interesting the difference. Look, if you have this is called a frog pad. And so it's basically cut down to about 1/4 or 1/5 the size of a regulation keyboard, but you can see all of the keys that you need, and they're in different colors. There's green and white and yellow. And so if the letter you're looking for is written in green, you just hit the green button and then you hit that letter. If it's white, you just go ahead and hit it. If it's orange, you hit the orange button and then you hit whatever's corresponding with that. So it has a good look to it. But if you take a look at this particular keyboard, the BAT keyboard, it's incredibly, you wonder how you could ever use it. It's a black box.
Is it supposed to be for the same purpose?
It's the exact same purpose.
This
is a black box that has seven keys on it, four on the left side that are black and three on the right side that are red. One's red, one's black, and one's blue. And you just lay your hands on it. And in all the different combinations you can make with that, you just write the letters. You know, all the letters of the alphabet, all the numbers, all the punctuation that you need can be created very easily with just one push. So if you ask students, if you hold these two up, one that looks like a typewriter and one that isn't, they always pick the one that looks like a keyboard. But in actuality, this is the one on the left is a lot easier to use once you've taken the time to be trained on how to use it.
But this is more portable.
It is more portable, and that's part of the
Is this the iPads port?
This is the iPads port.
Okay.
Right? This is just, it's called a frog pad keyboard.
Frog pad, okay.
And it's an example of a one-handed keyboard, mm-hmm. but this is, even though it looks a lot tougher to use, mm-hmm. it's actually a lot easier to use once you learn how to do it.
So there's lots of options, lots of alternatives.
Incredible
right now.
Amount of options. We have the, you know, we also have the eye trackers, the ones that will track your eyes or track your a movement of your head. I mean, there's just so many different ways to interact with a computer that a lot of what we do is just focusing on that one area, trying to figure out how can we get this person fully active in the world of Facebook, Twitter, or whatever they need to do to be employed.
All right. Well, Bill Darling, thanks for coming today and telling us about all of these keyboards. And people, if they want to learn more about them, we'll post your website on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And thanks again.
Thank you very much, Anne. I appreciate it.
Bill Darling, he is Director of Assistive Technology of Ohio. And coming up, we're going to stay on the Ohio State campus and talk to some folks who are part of the OSU EcoCar 2 team. You'll have to stay with us to find out what that's all about. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Immigrants in Chicago work for some major American companies indirectly, you might say, via a whole bunch of middlemen.
I think they're trying to create a level of deniability that if there's a problem with the pay, that it's not their problem, it's the Reitero's problem.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a special investigation with ProPublica labor brokers and minimum wage workers, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace tonight at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. Expect sunshine today and a high near 78. Clear skies tonight, a low of 57. More sunshine and a high of 80 on Wednesday. Support comes from Kappa, partnering with Ohio State's College of Arts and Sciences to bring the Royal Shakespeare Company to Columbus. With their reimagined take on the Bard's classic, Julius Caesar, set in contemporary Africa, May 1st through the 5th at the Southern Theater. Details and tickets at kappa.com. And support comes from the State Auto Insurance Companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. As fuel efficiency standards become more strict in the coming years, the auto and or as gasoline becomes more expensive, the auto industry will be counting on the next generation of engineers to innovate. One way to make sure that young engineers are prepared to tackle those challenges is to engage them early on. A college competition called EcoCar 2 is designed to do just that. Joining us now to discuss EcoCar 2 team, the EcoCar 2 team here at OSU, is Sean Midland-Moeller from OSU's Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering Department. He's the lead advisor on the team. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Hi, Ann. Thanks.
Am I describing, is EcoCar the correct pronunciation, or is it Echo?
Yep, we go EcoCar.
Eco, okay, good. And also with us is Catherine Bovey. She's a PhD student in mechanical engineering and one of the student leaders of the EcoCar team. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Thank you.
You're in the second year of the competition. When the project began, you started with a regular 2013 Chevrolet Malibu. How did you get started, Sean?
The first year is entirely design, and that really follows what the industrial process is. There's a lot of focus on doing upfront design, which saves cost in the long run because parts are designed correctly. There's a lot less prototype development. So year one, they really kind of hold us back and make sure that we do a really good job designing. Year two, then, is the build year.
Is it the same team of students all 3 years?
It depends. We have students. We actually have students that have started in high school doing internship programs through, you know, their program, and then came all the way through and will be entering graduate school here next year. So it's a broad range.
And how many students are working on it?
We have about 7 or 8 graduate students typically, and then 40 or 50 undergraduates.
Catherine, are you building a hybrid like a Prius or an electric car like a Chevy Volt? For those of us out there who understand very little. Can you help us?
The vehicle the Ohio State team is building is pretty similar to a Chevy Volt, at least in concept. It has, you know, an all-electric range for so many miles, about 40 or 50 miles. And then we have an engine that runs on ethanol or E85 that gives you the range extension as well.
How did you decide to get on the team?
I joined the team when I was a junior here at Ohio State for my bachelor's degree, and I was looking for a research project. And at the time, they had just gotten this really cool 1.8-liter engine from Honda. And we were working on converting it from compressed natural gas to ethanol or E85. And so we had to pretty much redo all of the control code for it. So all the spark timing, the fuel injection, the emission system, that all had to be redone. And so I was one of the students who did a small research project on the emission system to kind of redo it. And I really loved it after that.
Now, wait a minute. You were a junior. So that was, then you were a master's. You got your master's.
Yes.
So that's 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah,
and now you're in your fifth or sixth year now?
This is, I think I'm towards the end of my fourth year right now.
Okay, so I thought this was a three-year program.
Yeah, the DOE and General Motors have basically had this type of competition for a long time. I came to OSU in 99 as a graduate student, and I was actually on what was then called Future Truck. And before that, it was Future Car.
Okay.
So there's been continuously what they call advanced technology vehicle competitions, which has been, you know, that's really the focus of this competition is to generate the next generation of engineers that can go into the industry and meet these aggressive fuel economy targets and emissions targets that EPA basically pushes forth.
So it's kind of a rolling competition then?
Yep. Yeah, they'll typically be anywhere between 2 to 4 years.
Okay.
It just depends on the cycle.
Okay. And when you talk about designing something like this, how much does it mirror what's going on at the auto companies, what they're doing?
Yeah, they really design in this competition series, it's 3 years for this year, and they really pattern after what they call GM's vehicle development process. So they would typically spend, you know, the lead time on a car from concept to showroom is, you know, 4 or 5 years. So they obviously compress that to make sure it kind of fits. They want most of the students to be able to see most of the phases.
Mm-hmm.
So they do condense it down. And we're not delivering a kind of a showroom quality vehicle. It's still expected to be a prototype. But we go through basically the design phase, what they call a mule build, which is building a vehicle that has basic powertrain functionality. That's where we're at right now. And next year, third year, it should look like a production quality vehicle.
Which, tell me, define that for me versus a showroom. Does it look like a car?
It does.
Okay.
Yeah. we're actually required to maintain the design elements of the car. So it still needs to be recognizable as a Malibu. But beyond that, we're given free rein to basically rip. I mean, the first thing we did was rip out the powertrain. So no more anything that made the part go in the car go gone, and then insert our own stuff and cut lots of holes and add extra battery packs and electric motors and all the gee whiz stuff that goes into a Volt.
Catherine, how much does it feel like you're actually in a competition?
Is there any
pressure?
There's definitely pressure. I mean, we obviously want to do well. I mean, our team, Ohio State, has been in these competitions for a while, and we kind of have a reputation for doing really cool, really almost crazy things at some points with the complexity we take on, but we always do really well. And so, I mean, there is some pressure on us students to make sure that, you know, our car actually performs well at competition. But, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of times we just do this for the experience. I mean, we really love working on these hybrid vehicles and actually getting kind of industry experience while we're in college. So it's all worth it.
There are lots of competitions like this in engineering now,
yep.
Aren't there, Sean?
Yeah, we really focused on experiential learning activities because, you can only do so much in the classroom. And then it's really out in the labs and in the shop where the students really get a hone in on those applied skills that industry, you know, what they need for their careers. So it's a huge difference, and we're trying to roll out more opportunities moving forward. It is a focus of the college.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Catherine Bovee. She's a PhD student in mechanical engineering and a co-team leader of the OSU EcoCar 2 team, and also Dr. Sean Midland-Moeller. He is lead advisor of OSU's EcoCar 2 Challenge. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. If it's easier, check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So you said OSU kind of sets itself apart from the competition by doing sort of crazier outside-the-box type things. Can you give me an example that I'll understand?
All right. So a lot of teams will do a very kind of simple hybrid. They might do like a series hybrid like a Prius that, you know, the whole front powertrain just generates electricity. The rear powertrain powers the vehicle. Our team, like our vehicle is just able to do series mode. It can also do parallel through the road where all the powertrain components are directly connected to the wheels. It can do, you know, an EV kind of all electric range. And so it can't just do one mode of operation. It has three of them. And so that obviously increases kind of the level of complexity that, you know, we have to program into our vehicle and actually make work correctly.
Speaking of level of complexity, Sean, it feels like this is the kind of thing that the golden students get into, that they have to be the super duper students. But we're trying to educate and graduate as many engineering students as possible these days. Are there different platforms for different levels of students who are trying to become engineers? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And I mean,
not everybody's, super.
We're lucky at OSU. I mean, we have really high quality students.
Yes.
I mean, the engineering can afford to be selective. And the students come in, and you'll find that, I mean, I won't list names, but I have students that academically are 2.7, you know, 2.6 students that do phenomenal things on the shop floor. I mean, they get out there. I mean, they interface with they interface with sponsors. They do really great design. So people's attitudes are different. So you'll find that a lot of the people that might be kind of the stragglers in the GPA department will really excel in an environment like this, which is much closer to what they'll do in many jobs. So it's actually good for them to get involved in something like this, because I think it really helps their education, the kind of their self-esteem, knowing that, okay, they can succeed.
And you don't have to be the 4.0 brainiac. But they are smart. I mean, they're all smart. Yeah. They're just smart in different ways.
Yep.
Now, engineering is somewhat like, once you get into the engineering school, it's a family. I mean, you take care of it. You don't, do you have to maintain a certain grade point average, or once you're in?
Yeah, you can get put on academic probation through engineering. And one of the things that those of us that advise student projects do is we have to be really careful that the students, they give so much to these teams that they can, you know, the last person they look out for sometimes is themselves. So we do have to be careful that they don't get too hooked.
And what about well-roundedness? I mean, there's the big debate now out there about a good liberal arts education and what kind of value it has to people who are in engineering. Catherine, I mean, you're going to OSU. You had other kinds of requirements getting to this point. Are you glad, or could you have just done straight engineering and skip all the culture and so forth?
I mean, I took most of my kind of GECs or general education curriculum requirements or whatever they were when I was, you know, a freshman and sophomore. But I mean, they were pretty interesting, and it was definitely like an interesting experience where I was used to going to class with all guys, and all of a sudden it was like 50-50 again, versus guys. But I mean, there are certain classes, like, you know, the writing courses were helpful for writing. You know, the comparative studies course I took just was an interesting viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I really liked it. And then project teams like EcoCard too, like, we obviously do a lot of engineering, but I mean, we have business and outreach teams too that, like, I interface with on a daily basis, doing, you know, media events like this, or, you know, managing our budget or balancing our budget for once. And
are they out
of
the Fisher, I mean, School of Business? Is that the thing? Okay.
Yeah,
so it's not just the engineering school involved in this.
Yeah, and this team's very interdisciplinary. They do lots of business activities. There's project management, there's communication. So it's a pretty well-rounded. Even students just in this competition get to see a lot of different facets from more of the business side as well as the engineering.
And, well, you know, you mentioned, brought up the gender issue. What is the gender breakdown at this point, Sean? Do you have any idea?
For our team?
For the team.
We have,
you said, about 50 or 60 students.
Much higher than average. As far as our core team of the 20 people that are really involved, we have five women?
At least five,
which is, I mean, that's a lot.
Compared to
if you look at the general mix, I don't know what, you know, I'm just going
to
ballpark and say it's around 10%. You know, something like that in terms of the general student population in engineering.
How big of a deal do you think it is that you have some gender parity? I won't say equality, but some kind of gender parity when it comes to design and just the whole conceptualization of something like this? I mean, Catherine, of course you think it's important, but just generally, it's still really low on women venture.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, you know, diversity is a big deal, whether it be, you know, racial or, you know, gender. So, mm-hmm. you know, different people bring in different ideas. So even in engineering, I mean, people approach problems differently from their background. I mean, you can see, you know, we like to have the kids that grew up on farms because they
fix the tractor.
They know how to go in and pull out the welder and do that certain thing. And mm-hmm. other people, you know, from other backgrounds bring in different ideas, too. So it's definitely a... You definitely need that melting pot to do something like this.
Let's get back to the car. Where do you test drive the car?
Right now, we're fortunate that the project is kind of under the umbrella of the Center for Automotive Research. So there's obviously facilities there in terms of running dyno tests.
Is that?
930 Kinnear Road. So it's just off campus,
okay.
On West Campus. Then we also, through a partnership of the CUE and College of Engineering and Transportation Research Center, which is up near Honda, it's the largest private proving grounds in the United States. They give access to the teams to go out. They have a closed test track. And occasionally we'll run, we'll cone off parking lots in OSU, get permission from transportation parking, and run, you know, 0-60 kind of things in one of the West Campus parking lots that isn't being used. So they innovate. They find places.
Catherine, are you just working on one vehicle right now?
Yes.
Okay, so you don't have an extra just in case something...
No, I mean, we just have one. I mean, we do have our old competition vehicles, but we're not allowed to, you know, take them with us or anything. I mean, it has to be the Chevy Malibu.
So when is the competition? When does it all happen? And
so
this is the scary part.
Yeah.
The vehicle itself is shipping to competition around May 6th or 7th.
And so that's about it's coming right up. Okay.
This explains why Catherine looks a little tired. I got an email from her and her group at 3:30 a.m. last night from the shop.
You look great.
Thanks. But yeah, so we have a lot of late nights ahead of us. We're doing kind of component level testing right now, like actually making sure our electric motor spins or the engine spins or it can fire, because that's kind of important if you're getting ready to test it in about a week. And then so if the vehicle's shipping May 6th or 7th, our team is actually flying to Yuma, Arizona on May 12th.
Ooh, which one is of those long desert track things, one of those you see on the commercials?
It's actually, yeah, the GM's Desert Proving Grounds actually on a, it's, they sublease the land off of a military base.
Okay.
So it's one of those things, it's a test, it's a munitions testing ground. So they basically tell you, do not go off the marked paths because there could be unexploded ordnance out there. But yeah, middle of the desert, you know, scorpions, rattlesnakes, the whole works.
But flat.
But flat, yeah.
Very, very flat. All right, so you go out there, and what happens at the competition?
So when we first get there, we'll they have kind of a whole testing facility there, and so, like, our vehicles will be there when we show up along with all of our tools. And so we have about a week to try and compete in a bunch of different dynamic events and also pass our safety tech evaluation, because you can't compete in any dynamic events until you actually, you know, prove your vehicle safe to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And so once it's safe, you do fuel economy testing, emissions testing, an autocross course, a drivability and handling, noise, vibration, and harshness testing. And so you pretty much do the full range of tests a normal production vehicle would do, except for crash testing and durability, because this is a prototype and we don't have time to do durability testing.
Once again, you don't have extras.
No, yeah. We don't.
And how many people are in the car at a time? Is it just one person?
It varies. It's usually one or two people. A lot of the events are driven by, like, a GM test driver. Just because, I mean, it's their course, it's their roads, and they want to make sure that if something goes wrong, they have someone in the car who, okay, you know, can respond to conditions like that. Most of the events will have a student ride along, too, just in case, you know, the test driver doesn't really know what's going on. The student can say, oh, that's a normal noise, or, you know, that's fine, just in case they have any questions.
It's not going to blow up.
Yeah.
How many teams are you competing against?
There are 15 teams. So the process is actually interesting. It's a competitive entry process. So actually,
it's curated then, not just anybody can do it. Okay.
So the initiative for this comes from the Department of Energy, and they always partner with some OEM, so General Motors in this case. They've already announced EcoCar 3, which actually they have an RFP coming out in the next couple of weeks that'll basically lay out the application process. So I don't know how many proposals they tend to get. I think it's around 30 or 40. And then they basically just go through a vetting process and pick the best teams.
What are you competing for? Is it fuel efficiency standards? Is that always what the main focus is?
That's the main focus. So of the 1,000 or so points, I would say probably about half of them are related to efficiency. But as Catherine was describing, there's also, you have to bring a very well-rounded vehicle. They do acceleration. They check passenger capacity. And there's also a series of design presentations that go with it to basically check the student's understanding of what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty comprehensive evaluation.
And in the future, do you envision these kinds of competitions looking in other directions completely, like hands-free cars and that kind of a thing?
Yeah, they already have some things like that. The DARPA Challenge, which OSU's competed in, it's just basically the autonomous vehicles that kind of go out. There's been a couple of iterations, but one was basically kind of a desert environment, get from point A to point B, and then one was a city environment where the cars actually had to be aware of, you know, fake plywood pedestrians going across. And, so they definitely use universities in this fashion. You get, you know, there's an off chance, obviously, you get a really great idea.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of this stuff, they're very applied. So the pros in the auto industry know how to do these things pretty well at this point. But the biggest thing they get is the students.
They get the trained.
Yep.
So they're
getting students out of this program that are ready to go. And, you know, GM has lots of hiring statistics, and they actually track patents of people that have been in these competitions, and the patent applications filed within the first 5 years of people that have come through EcoCar, I don't know the number, double or triple of what they are on average for the students that don't come through the program. So they get innovators, which is what obviously the industry needs.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us today to talk about it. It's really interesting, and good luck in the competition.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Catherine Bovey, she's a PhD student in mechanical engineering and co-team leader of the OSU EcoCar 2. EcoCar 2 team, along with Dr. Sean Midland-Moeller. He is the lead advisor for the EcoCar 2 Challenge. Coming up, Russell Holly from Geek.com. So stay with us. We'll be right back on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Syria and the tough choices facing America with C.J. Chivers of the New York Times. He's been in Syria covering the civil war and has spent time with rebel forces there. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 65 degrees, sunshine today, a high near 78, clear skies tonight, a low of 57, sunny and another warm day on Wednesday with a high near 80. Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. Like most entertainment, video games can be a great escape. And for that reason, among others, game system developers are working on several technologies to make the video game experience more immersive. Microsoft recently shared a demonstration of where they are headed with something called Lumi. Lumi Room. Joining us now to discuss and tell me how to pronounce that and other gadget news is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holly. Hi, Russell.
Hey, I think it's Illumiroom.
Illumiroom, okay.
Yeah. You're pretty close either way, really.
Yeah, I guess there's kind of just, it's more about the cadence of how you say it. Illumiroom. Right. Okay. All right. So, I'm hoping we can post a link on our website at wosu.org/allsides so that people can see what we're talking about too. But try to describe what Illumiroom does.
Sure. So the way the demonstration exists right now, just above where you sit, there is a projector and a Kinect camera, Microsoft's Kinect camera that is usually next to the television to record you as a person as you interact. But this time, the camera is actually behind you, and it's capturing your entertainment center. It wants to know exactly what your entertainment center looks like and all the different shapes that surround your entertainment center. It then takes that information and feeds it into a projector that just basically paints a picture over top of your entertainment center so that when you play games, it can add things to the environment directly around you.
Is this technology what we've talked about in the past where you could do it against entire buildings?
This is really similar to that same technology. And really, it's just clever optical illusions with a projector. As long as the projector is aware of, what it is that you are looking at, it basically, takes a picture of your entertainment center in this instance, and then projects a picture of your entertainment center right over top of it, and then messes with that image in such a way that it looks like, the world around you is moving, when it's really just that image over top of, real life.
Does this involve 3D at all? Because some of the iterations of the program looked like you could isolate it to just, like, if you were in some kind of warfare game, you could just have the explosions kind of come off the set. Is it 3D at all?
The demonstrations that they had here were using a single projector, so it's not a 3D image. At least it's not a 3D image that would require that wouldn't require glasses.
Okay.
And there weren't any glasses in this demonstration, so it looks like this is all just 2D, just really, really clever optical illusions. And that's really, the whole idea here. You're playing a game, and really it can be any kind of game. It can be a racing game, it can be a shooting game, it can be a puzzle game, and the environment around the television is now interactive. So you move forward, and let's say you're in a game where you're running through the snow, and you move forward, and there is snow falling around your entertainment center.
And it's falling on the ground.
Right, it's falling on the ground and collecting on the ground. And when you move forward, the snow adjusts as though you are walking through the snow. That motion happens all around you so that it feels like the entire entertainment center is responsible for the video game. And Microsoft gave a bunch of different examples of how Illumiroom could be used, in this situation, as well as what their long-term goals for this project could be.
Okay, so just to let people know, I'm talking to Russell Halley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question or comment for Russell about anything regarding technology, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Maybe it's quicker to check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Or, you know, go to WOSU All Sides. You can tweet it as well. You talked long-term and short-term. I mean, long-term goals, I just see the military getting involved.
Well, I mean, long-term goals for Microsoft, like having this as an actual product that they've released instead of just a cool demo, because this is something that Microsoft kind of snuck in during CES this year.
Oh, okay. Did you see it then?
It was just a video. Okay. Not as impressive as the one that they just released. Just kind of, this is something that we're working on. So it was kind of a cool idea back then, but it was really hard to, you know, conceptualize what was really going on. And this video shows a lot more of what's capable. And then in the video, they showed that when this becomes a product that they just decide to sell, ideally what they want is a smallish projector box with a camera that sits on like your coffee table or something like that, where mm-hmm. it's just in front of you as the user and you know, projects onto the entertainment center around you. They made it clear that they want this to work on everything, you know, any kind of entertainment center, any kind of wall that you have a television, you know, with a Luma Room should be able to function.
Will it matter what game system you're using?
I would assume that this is going to be pretty Xbox specific if Microsoft is working on it.
Yep.
But it's, you know, like anything else, you know, it's not hard to imagine that Sony or Nintendo or anybody else that would be working on a video game system, you know, would lag too far behind in coming up with their own version of it as far as, you know, an interactive system. And really, this concept at its base level has been around for a while. There was a television manufacturer for a while that connected strips of light to the back of their televisions that would project soft colors all around the edge of the television. That would match whatever was going on the television to make it feel, you know, more immersive. And that was a really basic version of this. But a lot of the same effect was there because the color, it would basically be a solid color. So like if a person, you know, walked into view and they had a red shirt, it felt like they were walking from, you know, from beside the television as opposed to, you know, limiting it to the box that you're watching.
It can be as simple as giving you the impression that you're going through a tunnel with the lighting system.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really, really simple stuff, you know, or it can be terribly complex. You know, really, really environmental. And the cool thing with how Microsoft does a lot of stuff with video game developers is that they'll release this as a concept like they've done here, and then they'll build a toolkit and they'll hand it to video game developers. And those guys will take it and go as far as they possibly can with it. So you'll have racing games where, you know, it, like you just said, it feels like you're actually, you know, in the tunnel that you're racing through in that particular thing, or you know, underwater or some kind of environment like that, where it really, you know, it really drags you into the entire experience.
Is one of their challenges making this something that's affordable?
Price is definitely something, because projectors that can fill a wall like that and that are also bright enough to do that in the average living room are kind of expensive. And that's going to be a challenge. I mean, as it stands right now, you could probably do this with a $200 or $300 projector, but you'd also have to go and make sure that the room was completely dark when you started.
You know, I just thought of something. I imagine they've been using this technology to some degree or another in some way in movie making.
Think that there's probably some similarities there as far as, you know, how those kind of illusions are generated. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've been talking about a Luma Room. If you have a question or comment about that, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. But we'll move on for now to the Samsung Galaxy S4, a new phone on the market. But you said that buyers might be surprised by how much memory it has at first.
Well, in some cases, it would be how much memory it doesn't have.
Okay.
The box of the Galaxy S4. The Galaxy S4, very much like the iPhone 5, comes in a variety of different storage volumes. They start at 16 gigabytes and they can go up as high as 64 gigabytes. What sets the Samsung phone apart is that it also has the ability to add storage through a micro SD slot so that you can potentially put, you know, significant amount of storage on your phone. But most of the stores, you know, Verizon and AT&T and T-Mobile and these guys are going to carry the least expensive model, you know, first. And then you can request the more expensive model with more storage either from Samsung or from the carrier directly. Samsung has a lot of stuff on their phones to begin with. And as a result, the 16 gigabyte model only comes with right around 8.5 gigabytes of actual memory free.
Which means in normal people words, what?
It means that you're getting about half of what you actually think you're getting on the box. Because there's a lot of stuff on there. So if you go to install a bunch of apps or take a bunch of pictures or record video or anything like that, and you're expecting a certain amount of storage, you're going to get about half of that.
Well, how much storage, how much memory do we really need on a phone? I mean, what is your recommendation for, you know, your average user?
I think it's one of those things that it increases over time based on usage. I mean, smartphones are kind of a crazy thing to really gauge that on, because you look at a phone like the Galaxy S4, where it has a 1080p camera, which means you can record video at incredibly high resolution and show it on televisions and have it look really nice. But at the same time, every minute of video that you record takes up a lot of storage because it's taking such a large file. We've got video games that are available in the Google Play Store and Apple's App Store now, where the games themselves take up a significant amount of space because they're such high quality games that are really more like video games you would play on a television.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usage based for sure. I mean, if you take a lot of pictures, if you record a lot of video, or if you play a lot of games, then you're gonna run into this problem. If you use your phone as a music player, then you're probably also gonna run into this problem where storage is gonna be something that is gonna creep up on you a lot faster than you probably feel like it should.
And the difference with most of the rest of them, at least, is that you can't amend that storage level. But with the Samsung Galaxy S4, you can. You can add on.
You can either buy a larger version, or okay, in either case, you can add on storage through the micro SD slot. There are certain kinds of data that you can't store on the micro SD card slot, but that's a pretty limited range of users. But really, it's one of those things that, you know, it's more of a, you know, be aware of if you're planning on getting this phone.
Okay.
That, you know, the first time you start the phone up, you're going to notice that there's not quite as much storage on there as the box does.
We have an email from a confused listener. Sounds like my cup of tea here. It's about tablets. Do all of the Nexus and tablet type devices that play video accept video downloads in the MP4 format, or do they have to be specifically compatible with that?
MP4 is a standard, so it's really hard to find something that doesn't accept MP4 anymore.
Okay, so it's user operator error, confused listener.
Yeah,
you're not doing something right.
It may also be that you need to find the correct application to play it. If you're using something like an Android player, it may be that it doesn't actually come with a media player, depending on which tablet it is. In which case, the Google Play Store has a lot of them that are either free or like a dollar. That'll handle MP4 just fine.
All right. So Google Now is on iOS. Google and Apple, tell us about this. Google and Apple Care competitors. What is this in the smartphone space?
Google Now. Yeah, okay, Google and Apple are pretty serious competitors. And the iPhone released this kind of language dictation and personal assistant thing called Siri a little while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Android has a service that is very similar called Google Now that functions in very much the same way. And that service is now available on iPhones and iPads. And it's kind of a big deal if you are a consistent user of Google products. If you like Gmail or if you use Google Search for a lot of things, then Google Now kind of picks up and does some really interesting things with the information that you kind of feed Google as you continue to use the service. For example, and this is my favorite example because I use this more often than I'm willing to admit. I will get an address from someone for a meeting that I'm supposed to go to, and I will type the address in and look it up on Google Maps and see that it's not, you know, particularly far or you know, kind of get a route in my mind. Mm-hmm. And by the time I've gotten to the car, I can open Google Now, and Google Now will give me the estimated time to arrival, traffic, and the ability to navigate all automatically set up. I haven't asked Google Now to do this. It's just taken the information that it got from my search and applied context to it.
Without, and this is just without ever, you don't have to push a button, or it's just because you looked up an address.
Because I looked up an address, and then when I got in my car, I opened up Google Now. It knew that that was where I was headed and had already pulled up, you know, traffic to get there and things like that. It applies. It does a really interesting job of applying context to things that you do in such a way that when you go to use it, it's aware of things that you're planning on doing. Like if you've looked up movie tickets in Google search, or you've looked up show times for something, then you go to open Google Now later on in the day. There will be something in Google Now that will remind you, you know, that there are show times in certain places, and even in some cases, you know, directions to the movie theater that you frequent.
Jeez. Are there a lot of Android users right now using that?
Google Now is really popular. It's been on a lot of it's been on every phone that's been out in the last couple of months, and it's gotten a lot of attention because, you know, it does a lot of this kind of guesswork for you, and it's really kind of a fun thing to use. And it has a lot of the same features that Siri has as far as, you know, voice dictation and scheduling and things like that.
Okay, so what about, you know, iPhone users? Are they going to get it too?
It's available for the iPhone and for the iPad now. That's kind of the thing that they just released.
Okay, that's what we're talking
today.
About. Then. Okay.
Yeah, it's just available, just now available for the iPhone and the iPad, and it works really well on iPhone. I tested it out on my iPad mini, and it's the same thing. You know, if you are a habitual Google user, then Google Now will give you a lot of extra context for the things that you do, and it ends up being really useful. If you're not such a big user of things like the Google Search or Gmail or things like that, then it's kind of cool to use the voice features, but it's not quite as useful to you.
I'm kind of excited.
It's a fun thing. I definitely recommend anyone with an iPhone, you know, try it out. You know, especially if you're looking for, if Siri doesn't quite do exactly what you want it to. Then this is kind of a fun way to mix things up.
Siri doesn't understand my voice yet. That's the problem.
Really?
I don't know what the deal is with the voice thing.
Doesn't understand your voice?
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
I know.
You should definitely try out Google Now, because Google's voice recognition stuff is really good.
Strangers in the grocery store recognize my voice now, but Siri still resists the urge to recognize my voice. So,
have you turned on Siri and asked if it knows who you are?
No, I haven't.
You may want to try that.
Just ask.
Yeah. Probably shouldn't. That's a terribly narcissistic thing to do, but.
Well, you mean, do you know who I am?
Right,
oh, okay.
Exactly.
No. I thought you meant next series actually going to say, yeah, you're the person that owns this phone, but maybe not. Well, Russell Holly, thanks a lot for joining us today. Fun as usual.
Absolutely. I'll see you next week.
All right. And I will tell you how Google Now works for me.
Great.
All right. It's Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. I want to thank the All Side staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler and Rachel Quimby, production assistants Kiram Shaban and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, which you're listening to right now. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Once again, thanks for listening to All Sides. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.